This idea that an eco-friendly lifestyle isn't just good for the planet, but actually leads to more personal happiness, may sound awfully goody-goody. But it's borne out by some interesting new research. In fact, one of the most intriguing new directions in environmental thinking is exactly this, the connection between life satisfaction and planetary health. Writer Bill McKibben has been one of the leading voices on the environment for more than a decade. His 1989 book, The End of Nature, was one of the first to take the consequences of global warming seriously. Now, in a book called Deep Economy, he makes the case for an even more profound philosophical shift. The future of the environment, McKibben believes, depends on our ability to stop measuring economic success in terms of GNP and start thinking in terms of GNH, gross national happiness. In other words, McKibben told Steve Paulson, it's time to start questioning America's underlying assumption that bigger is better.
For a very long time, the only question we've asked is, can we make it bigger? And this is the sort of default assumption of our society. We've focused on this idea that more is better so relentlessly that we've failed to notice a couple of things. One, the kind of obvious one, is that more is wrecking the environment at a pretty fast pace. The less obvious, but in some ways more interesting, and more even more sort of subversive question that economists and sociologists really have only begun to pose in the last few years is economic growth actually any longer producing any gain in human happiness or satisfaction? The answer appears to be no. The data on American happiness and satisfaction indicates that the number of Americans who feel that they are living very happy lives peaks in about 1956 and goes slowly but fairly steadily downhill since, which is weird because in that same 50 years, our material prosperity is about trebled. Now, if the economy worked in the way that we intuitively think it does, those two curves should move more or less in tandem.
But there could be other reasons why people might be less happy. Maybe they don't like the material, the media culture that we're saturated with. That we could list all kinds of.
But it's clear that more isn't producing satisfaction. And the more we look at the data, it appears that the cause, more than anything else, is that the very act of gaining that affluence has weakened social connection and community enormously. And that's what people feel a strong lack of. I mean, think what we started to do in the 50s. We took that money and we began moving further out into the suburbs and building bigger houses. And we got the kind of first of the set of screens that we've been looking into ever since. And those things changed our lives in profound ways. They made them just sort of mathematically less likely that we were going to be in contact with other human beings. The number of close friends that an American has fallen dramatically in those 50 years. The amount of time that we spend eating with friends and family and things has fallen because, you know, we're taking all this time to make this money. We're living farther apart. We have more sort of toys to maintenance and things takes up our time. Without realizing what we were doing, we've traded off an awful lot of our kind of relational life for a very hyper-individualistic, accumulative life, and the trade-off doesn't seem to be working that well, never mind that it's also wrecking the planet.
So you're calling for a smaller scale of living. I mean, everything from the way we think about the economy to the communities that we live in.
I think that happily, the answer to both these dilemmas lies in somewhat the same direction, which is the creation of stronger local economies. And what's important about them may be less their scale than their localness. If, for instance, let's take food because it's the most obvious commodity. You use a lot less energy when you eat locally. One of the experiments I describe in this book is spending a winter with my family eating nothing that didn't come out of our small valley in Vermont where I live.
And it's worth pointing out that Vermont is a very cold, snowy place.
Cold place. If we can do it there, most of the country. And in fact, we ate really well. And, you know, we weren't ordering takeout from 2,000 miles away, which is essentially what the American food system consists of. So we were saving a lot of energy. But we were also making a lot of friends, the farmers and others that we were sort of beginning to rely on in a new way. And this turns out not to be the exception but the rule. A pair of sociologists followed shoppers first around the supermarket, then around the farmer's market. When they went to the farmer's market, these academics found that shoppers were having 10 times more conversations in the course of a visit. So, you know, an order of magnitude less energy being used and an order of magnitude more community being created, we're at least partway towards answering some of the real dilemmas that we find ourselves in.
Let me step back for a moment and talk about how you see the environmental movement in a bigger picture, because you've been writing about these things for a long time, for 20 years or so, going back to The End of Nature, which came out in, what, 1989?
1989.
When you first issued the warning about global warming. My sense is that back then there was this perception of you as this young guy kind of hectoring us, sort of saying, you know, better do something if we're going to save the world. The global warming story has certainly turned out right, I mean, from your perspective, I mean, or wrong, I should say.
I would have been quite happy to have been proved wrong on this one, Steve.
But as you look back, I mean, I guess I'm sort of wondering whether the way you think about environmental issues is pretty much the way it was back then, or has your style of talking about these things, has it changed over the years?
I think the things that I've gotten interested in have, in a sense, been broader. The second book I wrote was a book called The Age of Missing Information, which was an attempt to understand why we were doing nothing about climate change. I went and found the largest cable TV system in the world, which was in Fairfax, Virginia. It had 100 channels. I got people to tape for me everything that came across them for 24 hours. So I had 2,400 hours of videotape. Took it home, went to Sears and got a recliner, spent a year watching. You know, that was my life for a year. And there were a lot of ideas that came across the cable, but the central one was, and it really hit me like a ton of bricks to kind of figure this out, which I should have figured out long ago, but that the central message of the consumer culture in which we live is, you're the most important thing on Earth. You're the heaviest object in the universe, and everything orbits around you. And we've enshrined this idea as human nature, not kind of remembering that most people in most places have had other things very near the center of their identity, the tribe, the community, their relationship with the natural world or with the divine or something that gave them more of a sense of identity, not obsessively rooted in themselves. That idea now seems to me so deeply linked to the environmental crisis that we find ourselves in that I keep returning to it over and over and over again. Our sort of solipsism is the source of so much of this incredibly wasteful consumption. But it's also, it turns out, at least this is the thesis of this book, Deep Economy, is the source of a great deal of our unhappiness as well.
Because we're cut off from other people, from the rest of the world?
From all those things. You would think it would make us incredibly happy to live a life focused exclusively on our own, you know, stuff, but it doesn't. It's gotten very deep into our culture. You know, I did a piece a little while ago for Harper's about an evangelical pollster, a guy named George Barna, who did a poll a few years ago, and his poll was designed to tease out how biblically literate the 85% of Americans who call themselves Christians are. 75% of American Christians thought the phrase, God helps those who help themselves, could be found in the Bible, instead of coming straight from sort of Ben Franklin channeling Aesop. And in fact, of course, the gospel message is entirely the opposite. Love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, you couldn't be more opposite. But the degree to which, you know, all the parts of our lives have been sort of taken over by this obsessive focus on ourselves, I think is the dominant fact about the United States today. And it's reflected in so many things, including quite directly in the atmospheric composition, you know, the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere.
Bill McKibben's most recent book is called Deep Economy. He spoke with Steve Paulson.